out again. They got the claws in you, my friend, into your claim.
Good afternoon, San Diego. We are podcasting live with the Justice Team Podcast. It is now, the sun is going down a little bit. It's still hot. I just came from a Padres game, saw a couple innings. Manny Machado hit a home run, and I'm coming on. And we have a very special guest star, a real trial lawyer out of New Mexico. Please introduce yourself to my right.
Randy McGann.
The Randy McGann.
I don't know about
Let's
that.
Let's be clear.
Is it like the Ohio State University?
You have to say
Randy.
The Randy McGann. There you go.
Okay. Yep. Notable author, incredible advocate, woman to inspire.
But enough
all.
About myself.
I mean, come on. This is the day to be in San Diego, am I right?
It's perfect.
Okay.
It's just perfect.
Welcome, Randy.
Thank you.
And we got let's introduce ourselves to the people that aren't watching on YouTube, which I hope everyone is watching on YouTube. But for people that don't want to see Brandon's ugly face, Brandon, please introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Brandon. I'm in my ugly face, apparently. I don't have to be here, you know.
He's my little brother. I can get away with that. Of course, we got
bigger
Randy
little
McGann.
Brother.
What?
Yeah, bigger
he's,
little
he's
brother.
Bigger now. He's bigger when he was 13. Ibieti?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Ibieti Sec. Pleasure to be here. And I just have to say, it is an honor to be sharing the booth.
The pod.
It's a pod.
The pod with Randy.
I like to call it the Justice Team Airstream.
Oh, is that what it is?
Justice
Whatever
Team.
It is, I'm glad to be here.
That's great.
So we're going to jump right in. This is the AAJ conference, which is a national trial lawyers conference. So we get a different perspective from people around the country. A lot of our podcasts have been like California-centric, but now we get the national perspective. So Randy, why don't you give us a little taste of what it's like to practice specifically in your community in New Mexico, but also on a national scale, kind of what are the hot button issues that we're talking about and how have you like practiced?
Well, let me tell you about the Wild West where I practice. So lots of my practice is cases involving men behaving badly.
Mm.
And so, and not in the sense of the Me Too movement, although we have some of those too, but it's more testosterone does something to you guys, I'm afraid, that makes you not always act the wisest in certain situations. Our most recent case is one where a man and his buddies decided to mount a tire by spraying ether around the rim and lighting it on fire, which is a way you can do it. You can see that on YouTube. It's probably the most dangerous way you can mount a tire. But instead of just using ordinary tires, he was building giant monster tires. So he set the tire up. The YouTube videos you watch are of the tire laying down, and sometimes they explode and they shoot up into the air. But he, instead of doing it that way, stood this giant monster tire, which is about as big as his Airstream, up on its side. And because it was a big tire, used two cans of ether instead of one and had his buddy stand right in front of the rim. And when he lit it on fire, of course, and said, "Come closer, you got to see this."
Famous last words.
That's the famous last guy words. Watch this.
I think I could beat the train.
That's it. That's it. Killed his buddy. I mean, just killed his buddy.
No.
So we have lots of cases.
So
like,
who are you going after in that case? Not.
We were going after the man who did the stupid thing, and also the landlord who was allowing this kind of stuff to go on in this monster truck shop too. So yes, very interesting.
But, so Randy,
I put out the word: don't ever try that at home. Don't ever do that.
So Randy, how many trials do you think you have under your belt? And I'm talking from like you impanel the jury, whether it settles after that or not. How many think you have?
Probably 130, something like that.
I don't think I've even handled 130 cases in my career, let alone trials.
The frustrating thing now is the better you get at this, the less trials you have because people don't want to try a case against you.
The mark on your back. They're like, I got to slay the dragon.
Yeah, occasionally that does happen. That happened a couple of years ago. Somebody actually said that we're not going to settle with you because I want to be the one who takes
I want to be
down.
V1.
So, Randy, with 130 trials under your belt, do you still get nervous before a trial? What do you do to prep? How do you get ready for battle?
So I don't have nerves anymore. It's not that. It's just a little sort of tingle and excitement about getting ready for trial. And now I'm more concerned about my clients, because of course I've done it a bunch of times, but it's the first time for them being in the courtroom. So we try to do a lot to make them feel
more comfortable. Do you have any superstitions that you keep to during every trial, or does it change?
I never change my underwear throughout.
Wait a minute.
No, that's
throughout
not
your
true.
Entire
that's
life.
Not true.
The same
it's not true.
Underwear.
I just made that up. I just made that up.
Wow, same.
Same underwear all the way through the trial.
Every day.
The, every day. Every day. No, that I don't really.
And it's the same pair from
same
trial
pair.
Number one.
That's it. That's it.
At
I, my lucky pair. My lucky pair that I always wear. And the same.
Smithsonian. Are you listening?
No. You really don't have any superstitions? I think every Evie, do you have any?
Well, you know, I like to make sure that I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich ready in the morning. I try to make sure that I take the same route to the courtroom every day. And if I'm lucky, I get the same parking spot. But really, it's just the routine.
Yeah.
And but if it's thrown off, I think I'm okay. But I always wonder if people have those same superstitions.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not very superstitious. I'm all about reason as opposed to superstition. So reason and facts.
I'm not superstitious, but I'm a little stitious.
Are you a little stitious?
Yeah, that's yes. a Michael
semi,
Scott from The
semi-stitious.
Quote.
See, I think all of history, the great highs and lows of history are the battle between fear and superstition and reason and common sense.
Mm.
And sometimes our world is on the reason and common sense side, and sometimes it's on the fear and superstition side, which you see a little bit going
right.
on right now.
This
right.
is like Confucius time right here. I
oh,
love it.
There you
I, yeah,
go.
I have a couple questions that I love to ask trial attorneys.
Alrighty.
I asked John Gomez this yesterday, and he had an immediate answer. Was there ever a situation, I mean, over 130 trials, I'm sure there has been a case or situation like this where you've questioned whether or not you want to keep doing what you're doing, or if you question the justice system, just a result, whether the judge or the jury, just so unfair that you said, this is, I'm not cut out for this anymore, or...
So the answer is no.
Really?
But...
Stronger
losing,
result than
most. But losing sucks.
Yeah.
I mean... Are we allowed to say sucks on a podcast?
Yeah.
You can say whatever you want.
Trust me, these guys, anything
okay.
goes.
So you lose a case you shouldn't lose. And you go home and you put the covers over your head and you stay in bed for, 48 hours. And then you get up and you go on. And probably losing is, it's the thing that people, young lawyers, fear the most. But it's the best thing that can happen to you because you realize, oh,
yeah.
The sun still comes up.
Right.
I've had the worst happen to me that could happen. And I've survived and I can still go on after here.
Yeah, for me, if we take a bad beat on a case or we lose a trial, I'm always... We can move on. The attorneys can move on. The firm
clients,
will keep going on.
It's hard.
We will. Money will keep coming in. We didn't make any money. We might have lost some money, but I always that is their one shot.
Right.
That's
right.
Always what I struggle with the most, dealing with their rejection.
So do you have like one case or one client that really resonates and you remember like, man, how is that person doing? Because the system just didn't work for them.
Well, I've only lost six.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay.
All right, get her off the air.
This is say it again. Randy.
So
only six.
Six. And most of them, we'd settled with somebody else so that they didn't get completely shafted by the
jury.
So
you're not doing a lot of disputed liability slip and falls, some minor impacts on tissue.
No property damage.
No, we're not doing those.
So what would you say is your bread and butter case? Like, where are the most... You said men behaving badly, but is there anything else?
I think that's it. I mean, really, that's nice.
Is it on your website? I'll take all of your men behaving badly cases.
It is excellent. They are a huge source of
you
men.
We're pretty
you
dumb.
Men are a huge source of cases. So,
give me a match. I think this gas tank is empty.
That's exactly right. Well, no. So I'll tell you another one. All right.
I love it.
So, Boy Scout camp. The Boy Scouts, rather than hire loggers, say to a bunch of 9 guys who are sort of overweight fathers, "We'd like you to come up and clean up the camp for the summertime." And the men go out there and they say, we'd like you to cut down those 70-foot dead trees. Now, if there had been one woman the woman would have said, "Are you out of your mind? I'm not cutting down dead trees. This is crazy." So, but to a man, when they then said, "We want you to cut it down and we're going to give you this chainsaw," none of them had ever used a chainsaw before. But there you go. That's exactly it. To a man, they said, "I've always wanted to use a chainsaw. My God." So So they're trying to make the tree fall away from this power line, and some guy has a great idea about he's got a winch on the front of his truck that he says, let's run it around this line here down to this other tree, and we'll just start pulling on the tree. They start pulling on the tree. Of course, all eight of them are standing right behind the tree so they can watch the chainsaw. And what loggers will tell you is you got to stand not just one tree length away, but two tree lengths away because it can fall and knock you down. And they're all looking at the chainsaw instead of looking up at the top of the tree. As they pull the tree, the top 20 feet of the tree fall off, hit my guy on the head. He doesn't come out of the hospital for 18 months.
God.
And then he's brain injured for the rest of his life.
So did you get that's, the Boy Scouts of America? Did you
I got to the sue the Boy Scouts of America. And I must tell you, the local Boy Scouts were really nice, but the National Boy Scouts of America... the worst defendants, most lyingest defendants that I ever had on a case. It was quite discouraging.
Did anybody yell, Timber?
Nobody said any of that. They were all just watching that chainsaw. They were all watching the chainsaw. So that's it. You see, that's a great source of... And just one woman. I'm telling you, one woman had been there, it wouldn't have happened. The whole thing wouldn't have happened.
So are your cases mostly specifically in New Mexico, or are you traveling outside of state?
Mostly New Mexico. We have a few cases outside the state, but mostly New Mexico.
And, you know,
we sort of
I
get our choice of them in New
Mexico. I think I talked to you about a year ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
About what?
Where I was asking for a recommendation for a spine surgeon in New Mexico.
And I said, don't have it done in New Mexico.
Correct. You,
that's what
you
I
100% said, don't do it in New Mexico.
That's right.
And why is that?
Because we don't have very good health care in New Mexico.
And
I don't know if that's true other places.
How frustrating is that for you, for your cases and your clients?
Well, it's a source of lots of medical malpractice cases, but it doesn't seem to improve the health care. I mean, they should. And the health care on the reservations is the worst of all because it's funded by the federal government. So it's like third world health care on the reservations.
So how are you, as like a trial lawyer in your community, or how are you guys trying to help solve that issue? Because when you told me that, I felt like the whole state, there's not a good neurosurgeon.
The whole state. No, I tell people, if you have anything serious wrong with you, get out of the state and go somewhere else. Go to Mayo in Arizona or somewhere that they have good doctors.
And is that an issue you have to deal with at trial? Is, you know, they're using these expensive doctors and they're going to... Because in California, for up until recently, you know, we had a case come down that says... The plaintiff has a right to choose their health care. You cannot mention insurance. You know, the defense always says you have to go through your insurance to mitigate damages.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, that we had a case all that come through in California that nipped that in the bud. But before that, it was, you know, they're racking up medical bills. They're going to specialists to inflate their medical bills. Do you ever have to deal with that?
No, not too much. No.
Yeah, I feel like most jurors understand that if you're injured, you want to go see doctors.
The best doctors.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why, you know, we argue for future medical bills to give them anything they want so they can go somewhere outside New Mexico and get some care.
So how often are you dealing, you mentioned the reservations, how often do you deal with, is it a different type of law? How do you navigate
it
through that?
It is. We have 26 tribes in New Mexico and different Indian tribes. And they were there first, so it really was their state first, you know. And each tribe has their own law. Most of it used to be oral, but they're now starting to write it down. So if you try the cases on the reservation, you need how you present what the law is you get your elder, the other side gets their elder, and they both talk about what they think the
law
is.
Have you ever done that? Have you advocated for against an elder?
We have. And if you go to federal court and they have to apply Navajo law or Acoma law, you have to bring in elders and have them testify in federal court to the federal judge what the law is of their tribe.
And if it's an oral history of the law, are you bringing in an expert?
Oh, yeah. We both have our experts.
Wow.
And one expert says the law is this, and the other expert says, well, that's not how I interpret the law. I think it's this. Yeah, it's fascinating.
That is fascinating.
So in addition to the Native American reservations that you're working with, I wanted to know, you now have 130 trials under your belt. What has changed in how you actually try cases over the course of those 130 trials? And when I say changed, I'm talking about are your trials now more expert heavy or intensive? Are you having to do more demonstrative evidence? Are you still trying cases the same way you tried them?
I'm not. The ability to have visuals has improved so much. It used to be you'd bring in these, you'd have a flip chart, you had to draw on the flip chart, or you'd have these giant poster boards that you'd make. You'd print up posters and you'd have, you know, like 20, 30, some people would bring in 100 poster boards and you'd be shuffling these poster boards back and forth. So things like PowerPoint and presentation programs make that so much simpler. You just put things on a screen. And jurors actually respond so well to demonstrative evidence because they're used to getting their information from screens. In fact, I think they may believe the screen more than they believe you when you're talking to them.
So how about, like, witnesses? Have you ever had a witness that was just so vile and disgusting you just beat them down to the point of breaking down?
Yes.
And how much pleasure do you take?
That's actually on, it's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
It's a guy named Bill Lewinsky, who is a guy who pretends to be an expert in and force used by police.
Was it a civil rights case?
Was actually a case where I was appointed as a special prosecutor to prosecute for the first time ever in New Mexico two police officers for shooting somebody. That was about 3 years ago. And so they shot somebody on videotape, a homeless guy, and none of the, well, the local prosecutor was going to indict them. They immediately then began investigating her, the police department. And then they moved to recuse her because she had a conflict because they were now investigating her. So she asked me to come in as a special prosecutor, and I said, absolutely not. It's the first prosecution ever of police officers in Albuquerque. You've got to get a real prosecutor, not somebody who sues cops. And so she went to every prosecutor in the state. There were 14 different prosecutors and the AG, and asked them if they would look at the file and take the case, and they all said no. So she came back and said, I'm going to have to dismiss it unless you take it up. So I ended up doing it for free and took it all the way to trial.
Excellent.
So why is this on YouTube? Did you do something?
Well, so Lewinsky is a piece of work. Lewinsky is, he goes around the country testifying that whatever a police officer does is completely justifiable, including shooting people in the back.
Sure.
And he's come up with a theory about how it takes you so long to stop shooting once you start shooting. That's why they turn around. I start shooting you when you're looking at the front, and when you turn around, I just shot you in the back. I didn't realize because I couldn't stop shooting. It's kind of hogwash. And he's gone to testify in almost every big police shooting case. And the other way they use him is they bring him in before the grand jury where nobody sees him testify, and he tells the grand jury this was a justifiable shooting, and the grand jury doesn't indict police officers.
Right.
So anyway, it's a fun cross.
You had an interesting story about when you took the bar exam. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened right before, right after?
I just lucked out. My daughter was due the first day of the bar exam. And luckily came a day early, that's all. So I went and sat on a big pillow for 3 days and took the bar exam. But
wait,
people
what?
Think it's so amazing. But the truth is, look, all the pressure was off me, because if I flunked, everybody would say, well, it's not because she's stupid. Or she didn't study.
She had that baby.
So I had the best excuse. So all the pressure was off me to take the bar exam.
So what, changing gears a little bit, so in New Mexico, is there a type of legislation or something that the advocates in your community are pushing for against insurance companies that may be different than California? Because here we've got these Med-Mal caps and tort reform. Are you experiencing the same things in New Mexico?
We've got caps, and we'd like to get rid of those. We were one of the first states to have caps because all of the insurance companies left New Mexico because we weren't big enough to give them enough business, so they left, and so they had to create the first sort of cap system in New Mexico so they could self-insure, these doctors could self-insure. But now we have enough people where insurance companies would provide insurance, but they still haven't gotten rid of the cap system. That was the whole reason for it. But we're also fighting the same things you are here. That is that, which is hard, it's the it's arbitration. It's taking away your right to jury trial. That so many of the, if you put your loved one in a nursing home, you don't realize in that long form there's an arbitration clause saying you're giving up your right to jury trial if they kill your granny.
Kill your granny.
They kill your granny often.
I do have some viewer questions for you.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we put these on Instagram, like, and they responded to Instagram.
Oh. Holy cow.
So on Instagram, we're already getting some questions. So a viewer question, this is from April B. for May.
April Bonifato. She's from Las Vegas.
Okay. Oh, I know April.
Love her. Love you, Randy.
It's mutual.
That wasn't a question. That was just her. Right.
That was her viewer
comment. That was her viewer comment.
That's very good.
From @Hendorito. Ask her about the use of analogies in cross-exam. How do you use analogies in cross-examination?
Well, you use them in a way to tell the jury what you think about the witness or why you think they're telling a lie. For example, on an expert, to say to the expert at the beginning of cross, you've heard the phrase, actions speak louder than words, haven't you? And the person says yes. And what that means is, if you want to really know what somebody thinks, you don't look at what they say when they're being paid a lot of money, but you look at what they do. And then you compare what the expert has testified to the jury with about what he does in his own business, for example. If he said, for example, that in a convenience store it's okay to have one clerk on duty, but he has a security company where he requires guys to work in pairs, you then say, here's your words for the jury, and you write it on the board, and here are your actions. And then you go through each thing that contradicts them, but you've sort of set up the overarching analogy at the beginning to carry through for the whole cross-examination. So there you go. That's kind of an example of that.
Evie.
Yes.
Evie hosted a Women in the Courtroom podcast for us. Mm-hmm. And I listened to it. You know, Brad and I are white men. We don't know some of the issues that women deal with in a courtroom or in the practice of law. So, Evie, were there any things that came up or questions that you asked that you would like to pose to Randy?
Well, there are so many. I mean, just listening.
One of the questions that Michelle had was, what size heels do you wear?
Oh,
like,
yes.
Something like that example. I have no idea that
was
even a process.
Randy, I know, has an incredible presentation that she has done where she basically demonstrates the history of women attire in the courtroom, from the time they were dressing like men with bow ties to the Ally McBeal with the short mini skirts and the 4-inch heels, to present day, and what her position is on how best to connect with the jury in terms of attire. And so I would be interested in you sharing with our viewers kind of where you think
that's one of the big changes that I've seen, because when I first started practicing law, there weren't any women in the courtroom, and so we all dressed like men.
How many women are in your law firm right now?
Well, 4 women partners.
That's amazing.
And
yes. Congratulations.
Then we don't have any men partners, but not because we're biased. We have a couple
because
men.
Because
they
behave badly.
Because you behave badly.
Because they see a chainsaw.
Because
they
want to cut things up. It's really horrible. Yeah. So we have all women partners, but we've got 3 male associates and a woman associate too. So yes.
So this was an interest. So when you started practicing, what was the attire?
You dressed like a guy, which is that you wore black suits or blue suits, and you wore a white shirt, and you wore those little fakey rosette ties that, you know, mimic guys.
Like bolo
ties? No. Like they were like little rosettes. They don't.
Oh,
in fact, when I did this demonstration for the Colorado Women Lawyers, where I just put all the stuff on, and then I took it off, and so then it was this, and then it was this. I had to go look online on like eBay to find one of those rosettes, because they've stopped making them, thank God. Anyway, so that was it. And then you would put your hair in a very severe bun, and you would go in looking like a guy and walking like a guy and talking like a guy. And, of course, then I saw myself on television coming out of the courthouse once and said, my God, I look like my grandfather. And said, that's not really me, and started developing my own style. You know, sort of feeling out different things to wear, and finally came what I'm most comfortable wearing is not a suit, not what you think. And I know you guys think this is like a frivolous question for women, but women don't have any examples of other women in the courtroom to emulate.
That's exactly what came up during
the
podcast that she hosted, and they said, you know, we don't have examples of how we're supposed to act because there just hasn't been
that many.
There haven't been that many, and so my what I came to finally was, when you poll people about what they think about lawyers, guess what? They don't like them much. Liars, shysters, blah, blah, blah.
Men aren't very likable.
But when you ask them what you'd like lawyers to be, their answer almost universally is they'd like lawyers to be teachers. And if they add an adjective, they say they'd like them to be caring teachers. And so who were all your teachers as you were growing up?
All the ones that we liked.
They were all women. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm in the courtroom, I dress like a teacher. I wear dresses and sweaters, and that's what I'm most comfortable with. And that seems... And since they don't like the lawyers, they look to you to explain things for them in the courtroom.
Right.
Right.
So if you have any piece of advice for someone, say, they're at a firm and they think they want to be a trial lawyer, or they're not getting the right opportunity and they want to go out on their own. What piece of advice would you give them is, like, you at some point you made a decision that you want to start your own firm.
Right.
So how did you make that decision, and what would you advise someone in that position you were in then of what gave you the confidence to do it?
Well, you assume it was confidence. It might have just been, I was young and stupid and thought I could do this. I just say, go and try it, because you can always find a job if it doesn't work out, you know. And so when I went out on my own, there weren't any women law firms at all in New Mexico. And I went to my bank that I had been banking with for, you know, 10 years, sat down with this old lady, I can still see her face, a loan advisor, and had done a whole plan, a business plan, and here were all the cases I already had, and I was going to do all that. Here's when they would pay off. And I was asking for the huge sum. It seemed like so much money at the time, $10,000. I wanted a $10,000 line of credit. Presented, did my whole presentation.
That pays for like one expert right now.
Well, now I know. But back then, this is like 1980. So she leans over, she pats me on the arm like this and says, honey, I think you better keep working for somebody else.
Oh,
wow.
And I said, you know, honey, I think I need to find a new bank, is what I said to her.
Honey.
And went and found a new bank.
It reminds
and then
me of a Pretty Woman when she says, you work on commission, right?
Right, yeah.
Big mistake.
Big mistake. Well, that was exactly yes. right. That was exactly right. So that was it. And I don't know if that was confidence or just like pure D foolishness. Oh, look at these.
Yeah.
Somebody
Rolling
really
in.
Is out there listening, huh?
There are people out here engaging.
Oh, my
gosh. Real time.
Yeah. All kinds
don't look at the
questions.
Question. Did you just look at the question? Here, you can ask her the question.
I am told to ask you about the grapefruit.
Oh, Lordy. Okay, so I'm always trying to think of creative things to do in the courtroom to make people think, to understand what's really going on. So we had a case where a woman was went to a doctor who she thought was a doctor, but he was not. He was just the owner of the doctor of the clinic, and the doctor let him play doctor. And he misdiagnosed her with something when she had a cough, took an X-ray, and said she had mycoplasmic pneumonia, and it would come back on her. And so she didn't need to come back, and that's why she didn't find out till 2 years later that she now had stage 4 metastatic lung cancer. Anyway, the other side hires the finest-looking man you ever saw, expert, from Beverly Hills. He looked kind of like Lee Iacocca. He had this silver hair, this doctor, and he'd come up with this theory. He alone, of all the doctors in the entire country, had come up with this great theory of his own, which was that once you could see lung cancer on an X-ray, it was already too late. It had already metastasized. And this theory of his made him a very popular expert. And so he went around the country and made probably, you know, 75% of his income testifying in cases where people had misdiagnosed lung cancer, saying, so what? I think it had already metastasized and it was already too late if they could see it on X-ray. And so I just thought that was so foolish. So after pointing that out to the jury, that's where he got most of his income, and then pointing out this great hypocrisy, which was what he did with the other 25% of his time, which was he treated people with lung cancer, and he didn't tell them his theory that they were just wasting their time. When I said, well, why wouldn't you tell him this theory that you're telling the jury about? He said, well, because people have to have hope, is what he said, and continue to pay his fee, and the same thing. So once we sort of exposed him as a hypocrite, I had him come down and said, you know, I'd like you to help explain this. And so I had a grapefruit. I put him in front of the jury and said, you recognize this? He said, oh, yes, that's a California grapefruit. I said, yes, because you're from California. Could you hold it up where this tumor was on her X-ray? And let's explain to the jury that this is much bigger than the actual tumor was, but I want them to be able to see this. And I said, I just would like to understand your theory. If you could cut this out before it metastasized, the person would live. Yes, I take the grapefruit away. Then I have him hold it again. And I say, okay, now help me understand this metastasis. Cells break off, and I take these little yellow post-its, and I throw them into the air. And some of them just die in the body. And then some of them go, and they land at the first area of lymph nodes. And then I ask him so sweetly, do you mind if I stick these on you? And he said, go right ahead. And so I stuck them all over here. We talked about where they went here. We talked about over here. We put some on his head. And the jury, who hated him because of his hypocrisy, was just laughing. The judge had, like, the file over her face. She was laughing so hard. And then he went back with his $1,500 suit. Probably now would be a $3,000 suit, you see. And sat down. He was so flustered. He sat down back on the witness stand, and it wasn't till redirect that he realized he still had all this stuff stuck on him, and he had the little grapefruit in front of him, and that was that.
So that's the grapefruit story.
That's the grapefruit story.
So we have, like, 1 minute left.
Okay.
And I wish we had another hour left. But we do have, would like some parting words of wisdom from you to the young trial lawyers out there that are trying their first case and they're super nervous. What would you tell them?
Oh, it's such a great profession. And you're going to be nervous for your first 10 trials because you don't know what's happening next. The first 10 trials are all spent saying, what was that rule number I'm supposed to object to? Oh, I should have objected 2 questions ago. Oh, is now the time for a directed verdict? So just understand you're not going to be able to work on all your great skills till you've had 10 trials. And just learn as much as you can in your first trial and keep learning, because people need great champions out there.
It's called the practice of law for a reason.
That's
right?
It. That's what I'm learning still.
All right. Well, for Randy McGinn, Brandon Simon, Ibi Yedisek, I am Brad Simon. And there's, what do we close, Brandon? What do we say?
No sleep till justice.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this special edition of the Justice Team Podcast. That was our very own Jenny Anglin doing Policy Opener, paperback writer by the Beatles. And it's very, I mean, we're in the moment because we have Michael Cohen here, who is an insurance bad faith lawyer, amongst other things we're going to talk about. But introduce yourself. Thanks for coming on, buddy.
Thank you for having me. My name is Michael Cohen. I'm a trial lawyer, and a lot of my work involves suing insurance companies for policyholders.
And we also have another Justice Team member, Brett Gekler, could you please introduce yourself? Is this your first time?
This is my first time on the podcast.
Long-time listener, first time. Are you a fan?
Huge fan. You know, actually, the Bad Faith one that you guys did before with Ricardo was one of my favorites.
Wow. Well, Michael actually used to be... Was Ricardo at the firm when you were chairing our office?
Yes, we were there at the same time. He was there before and after, but I worked for Bill for a few years before I went out on my own.
Wow. And so, just educate... So, a lot of our listeners... A lot of trial lawyers, a lot of consumer advocates, but not everybody does insurance litigation, bad faith litigation. And, I mean, my question to you, so it seems it's so lucrative. It's such a fun practice area to actually hold insurance companies accountable, but I just find so few of the younger generation actually do it.
There's a reason for that. It's a fun practice area because it is fun to hold insurance companies accountable mm-hmm. when they haven't done what they're supposed to do and what they promised to do. But part of the problem is that what drove insurance bad faith litigation in California was the risk of punitive damages. Mm. And what happened was there were some important decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court that put limits on punitive damages. So at one time where a case could be smaller but might still end up being a worthwhile case if the insurance company behavior was sufficiently bad, mm-hmm. now it's much harder to make those cases worthwhile from a financial standpoint, because the insurance company will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a $15,000 case or a $15,000 claim, and they all know at the end of the day, even if you get a big punitive damages verdict,
it's going to be reduced
or taken away. I mean, we saw that just a few days ago with the Monsanto verdict.
Exactly. What did they reduce? There was a $2 billion, but it got reduced to $87 million.
And that's the problem. Now, there are some other jurisdictions like Florida or Texas that have one-way fee shifting. In other words, if you prove that the insurance company owed benefits they didn't pay, you can get your attorney fees you can in a civil rights case or an employment case. We can't do that in California.
Is there any legislative action or people are trying to change this at all? Or is it just, hey, man, insurance companies spending way too much money on their lobby to do it?
Well, it is difficult, mm-hmm. in part because it's technical, mm-hmm. and in part because if we bring up things like that, there's a lot of pressure on the legislature from the insurance industry and from the Chamber of Commerce to reject that kind of legislation.
Can we call the Chamber of Commerce something else? I mean, come on. It's like,
well, it sounds like it's a government entity.
Right. But it's not.
No, and not only is it not a government entity, which is a good point, because you're right, it sounds like it's got some sort of official status. But on top of that, it doesn't represent little businesses. It claims to.
Yeah.
But it really represents really large businesses, because some of my work and some of my cases are for small businesses against insurance companies. And a small business might be big to you and me, but compared to an insurance company, they're very tiny.
Yeah.
And the nice things about insurance companies is they're very democratic. They'll do this to everybody.
It isn't their equal opportunity ripper offers.
That they don't just do it to you, or they don't just do it to people they think they can get away with it. They do it to everybody.
So we dove right into some topics, but I want to give a little background about Michael. Michael, born in Oklahoma.
Right.
So are you a Sooner or are you a Poke?
Sooner. Between the Sooners and the Pokes, Sooners.
And then Austin.
Right. University of Texas, which is unusual.
Yeah. So, I mean, what game? Is it the Red River Shootout? Is that the big one, Texas?
They play in the Cotton Bowl. The way I look at it is I can't lose. Either team wins, I'm good. So
do you identify yourself as an Oklahoman or a Texan?
I mean, no. I would say people where I'm from Oklahoma.
Nice.
I love Texas and I love Austin, and I lived in Dallas for 7 years before I moved to Los Angeles. And I have family in Dallas. But when people ask where I'm from, Oklahoma.
Yeah. You're not a Cowgirls fan, are you?
How could you not be?
Yeah, I wore my cowboy boots for you today, Michael.
No, so. I appreciate that.
Brett, you have a very nice loafer on today. Is that a Ferragamo?
That is a Ferragamo, yeah.
Wow, this guy's fancy. I just saw the signature.
These are from my days as a corporate associate at the big firm where there I used to work. But those are making me feel right at home, the cowboy boots that Bob has on.
So, Brett, you also started on the defense.
I did, yeah. Right. Yeah, I started out at I guess you would call it a global corporate law firm. I was doing a lot of securities law defense, products liability defense of mass torts, stuff like that. Yeah.
So are you infiltrating conferences for the plaintiff bar? Or are you just, is that what you're doing?
That's right. Actually, Calla told me that in order to get on the listserv and get all the inside baseball secrets, I had to sort of abdicate my allegiance to the defense side just for a little bit and then steal all the trade secrets and go back. No, I've really sort of found my home on the plaintiff side here.
So Michael, after University of Texas, law school at Harvard.
That's right.
Graduated in 91. Is that
correct?
So any other, us filthy lawyers, we just go to these, you know. Where'd you go, Brett?
To law school?
Yeah.
UCLA.
Oh, God, you guys are too smart for me. I went to Pepperdine. But we do have the best trial lawyers coming out of Pepperdine. But then Harvard, I mean, Michael's the best lawyer ever to come out of Harvard around that time, but there was another great person that came out right around that time.
Yeah, I assume you're referring to President Obama. Yeah,
yes.
I was on the Law Review with Barack Obama.
I mean, on the Law Review with Barack Obama.
I was even on the editorial board with him. Like, they call the editor-in-chief is called the president, which I guess was foreshadowing. And then I was one of the editors of the Law Review
when
he was.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So when President Obama was on Law Review, did you guys ever share aspirations as to the type of lawyers you wanted to be? Or was he telling you back then, hey, man, I'm going to run the country?
Well, he did not say it directly to me, but I know there are people with whom he shared his ambition to be president. So he was talking about it even then. And people were talking about the possibility he could be president. So I think people had pegged him even before law school as having that kind of talent.
If That's Barack incredible. Obama practiced law, what kind of lawyer would he have been?
Yeah, I'm not going to speculate on that.
Come on, man. He would have been a plaintiff's child lawyer.
I'd like to think that. I'm not sure that's right.
I'm right. I'm 100%.
I'll defer to you on that
I'm 50%, 100% sure.
That's right.
Somewhere in the range. So,
beside my better half, she's often right, but she's never in doubt.
So then when did you come to Los Angeles? When did you come to California?
I moved to Los Angeles in 1999.
All right, so since 99, you've been representing the people?
I started out doing contract work, and then when my son was born, mm-hmm. I decided I wanted to reorient my practice, because at some point you tell your kid what you do for a living. And I didn't want to say I represent my clients zealously or just, you know, yeah. I didn't want to do that. I thought I'd rather do something that I felt better about. And so I first worked for a class action firm for a few years. And then I went to Chernoff, Bedard, and Darris. Well, now it's Chernoff, Bedard, and Echeverria, but at the time it was Chernoff, Bedard, and Darris to start their class action practice.
Wow.
And then after a few years there, I went out on my own.
So, I mean, Chernoff firm was known for, I mean, starting this, you know, insurance
in California,
litigation
that's right.
in California. So you were there on the ground with, you know, the pioneers in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that must be the way that you've, because it's so strange that it's just the younger generation. And do you think it's just the lack of punitive damages that why we're not getting into? Because it's strange to me, because I mean, every time I see it, it's like, this makes so much sense. You could take adjusters' depositions. I mean, it's like a dream.
I think real it is simply, I mean, the blunt truth of it is that it is not as financially rewarding a practice area as it used to be. No. You can, there are still good cases. As I tell a lot of clients, because I have to turn down a lot of potential cases, I tell people there's a lot of insurance bad faith, but there aren't necessarily a lot of good insurance bad faith cases yeah. in California as a percentage of, you know, the times I see bad behavior versus times I can do something about it.
So from a guy who's like a novice like me, what do you say makes a case good as opposed to just maybe borderline for you?
In terms of what makes a good insurance bad faith case is if it just strikes you as like, this is wrong. This isn't fair. This isn't what people buy insurance for. Insurance is more technical than that. And when you get into the cases, there will obviously be technical things. But most of the time, I can explain a good insurance bad faith case to someone without talking about regulations or statutes or rules and say, here's what the person, there's their loss. Here's what the policy said. Here's what the insurance company did. And I can usually do, if I can't do that in a minute or two, then I feel like I may not have a good case. Because at the end of the day, it has to boil down to one, two, three, four things that the insurance company either did that they should not have done or didn't do that they should have done.
So we hear a lot, the song that we heard play before was Policy Opener. That's a lot where we're hearing people want to, quote unquote, pop the policy. They want to open up the policy limit. Can you just give our listeners some just general advice on determining whether or not the policy's open and then common mistakes you see the insurance companies making to open policies?
You mean the attorneys making when they, which way? Oh, both sides. Okay,
yeah,
I'll
yeah.
do both sides. For people who don't already know this, to people who pop the policy or open the policy is to lay the groundwork necessary to recover a verdict from the insurance company if that verdict is more than the policy limits. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're talking about. And to do that, you have to give the insurance company a clear and unequivocal opportunity to settle within policy limits.
Within policy limits.
And that word, that the words I just used there, clear and unequivocal, comes from the case authority. Mm. And I'll put that in big heading on the letters if I'm looking at letters or editing them for people. At the top of the page, I'll say, clear and unequivocal opportunity to settle for policy limits or within policy limits. Bold, underlined, at the top of the page. So there's no mistaking that. Because I've been involved in cases where lawyers who aren't either not being careful or maybe aren't as skillful in this area as they should be, will write letters that you know the intention was a policy limit demand, but they don't say the magic language. And I've even seen the correspondence back and forth between the adjusters and the insurance defense lawyer saying, well, it doesn't look like a policy limit demand, so it's not a policy limit demand. But on the insurance company side, I think a lot of folks who treat the insurance company as the enemy, and I understand why they do, but it's easy to forget. If you've
They're
never
my
been
best friend. They've paid for all my houses.
Okay. And I'm glad you look at it that way. But a lot, I've learned that adjusters frequently are overworked. Mm-hmm. They have too much to do. And I'm not asking you to feel sorry for the insurance company, right, because they're hiring too few people or overworking them. And they don't give them the time or the resources necessary to do a good job and evaluate cases fairly. Do they make mistakes? Sometimes, sure. And sometimes, for whatever reason, you know, it's like any other industry. You'll have people who they take a dislike to the client or your client or something, so they make not even mistakes. They're being mean. That happens.
Yeah.
But more often is they're just not attending to it like they should. But then the insurance company is responsible because if they need to hire more people, hire more people. If you need to give them more time, give them more time. If you need to give them resources, give them resources. Because I think adjusters frequently are put in a difficult position where they have too much work to do to really evaluate cases properly. Sometimes it's obvious, you know, someone is in a horrible wreck and they're a quadriplegic and it's a $15,000 policy.
Oh,
that's easy.
I mean, we've had a few of those cases where we're just shocked that they don't tender the policy. We had a few eight-figure settlements before even verdict on 50. One was a 50, one was a 30 policy this year. One, the guy was paralyzed. A woman made a left in front of him. The client writes a demand letter, has all the magic language in it, and they write back saying, well, we need to see if you're, could you send us some of your bills, and we need to know if you actually have insurance. Could you let us know those things before we can make a decision on what to do with your case?
Yeah, no, it's...
What?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. That happens too. But on the flip side of that, I feel like sometimes lawyers are not as good as they should be, plaintiff's lawyers, at quickly providing the information.
Well, that's what... So we tell our lawyers that all the time. There's a recent case that came down about a 998 statutory offer to compromise where you kind of have to... Can't be hiding the ball. You have to give them as enough information as you can, right? Because I look at it this way. I tell my lawyers this. If this case goes to litigation, you want to go back and say, when the policy limit was demanded, what information did they have? Right?
What you said it is exactly correct. And sometimes people say, well, I want to set the insurance company. I'm like, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. Give the insurance company every opportunity, every fair opportunity to do the right thing. And then if they don't do the right thing, you've laid the groundwork. That's what you just said a moment ago is exactly right, which is it's about information. Give them as much as possible because ultimately for this talking about opening the policy, you have to have two trials, right? You have the first trial, the tort trial, and you have to get a recovery. And let's say you're successful and you get a good recovery. Now you've got to go to the insurance sue the insurance company and prove that at the time they made the decision to let the policy limit demand go by or reject it, that they had plenty of information. Any fair-minded person who looked at this would have said, this is worth more than X.
So when you file that lawsuit, the second lawsuit, in the discovery phase, what are you actually able to get access to as far as like the claim file and these things? Because our listeners, a lot of people are interested in this but don't really know what's there.
That's a really good point. You sue the insurance company, you have access to the claim file. But you have to be thoughtful about how you do that because frequently insurance companies will disaggregate the claim file, break it into parts so that what they give you, the claim file, isn't the whole thing. For example, they might have a separate server for emails that the emails do not automatically go into the claim file, or that they'll have access to different email addresses. One will automatically go into a claim file without them having to put it there, and others they'll have direct email addresses that don't necessarily make it into the claim file. And the reason they have that is, let's assume, oh, there's a company party, so they're sending an email out about the company party. That doesn't need to go to a claim file, but they will frequently have separate email addresses for different aspects of their work. And the insurance company frequently will not look for the emails that are from this separate server from a different email address. Or they'll keep photos in a separate place. Or they'll keep other kinds of memos in separate places. Or you'll have the opportunity, for example, they have what they call a round table or something like that, which is where an adjuster will talk with maybe their supervisor and then a branch manager or even a
vice president. So when they tell you they've got a round table, they really are round tabling.
Yeah, they will meet on a conference call.
And how's it documented?
That's a really good question. The existence of the round table will be in the claim notes, like on such and such a date. But you may not necessarily get all the information that was exchanged there. And so you have to pin down, you know, what documents were provided to all the participants. What did they get to look at? What did they get to see? And then track it through who did what. But ultimately what you're trying to do is to prove that at the time of the decision, the insurance company had more than sufficient information to agree that, yes, we should make a policy, we should pay the policy limits. And the thing is about those cases that sometimes gets lost is what you have there are two victims. The first is the tort victim, right, whoever's been hurt by the policyholder. But then when the insurance company, which controls the defense, doesn't pay the policy limit and then abandons the policyholder and says, okay, you're on your own. So they've created a second victim, right? And the policyholder with rare exception, didn't mean to hurt anybody. That's why they call them accidents, right? Someone got hurt, and they didn't mean to, and that's why they have insurance, is to protect themselves, but also to protect the people who they hurt accidentally.
And how do you find when a situation like that where you have that other person that's a victim here, the policyholder, what are some tips for our listeners from a coverage or strategy standpoint when you have what you believe to be an open policy, you have an attorney representing usually the interest of the insurance company. So what can you do to put more pressure on that insurance company, knowing that second lawsuit may exist
right.
for that other victim?
One thing you can do is you can communicate to the defendant an offer to take the assignment early. Mm-hmm. In other words, the right to assign the benefits under the insurance policy are assignable even before the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you have, let's say you've made the policy limit demand and you feel the policy is open, and you're taking a deposition of the defendant, the policyholder,
you can
say, you know, Mr. Defendant or Ms. Defendant, did you know that we made an offer to settle for X?
Objection, counsel.
Keep going.
Yeah.
As if we just keep going.
And did you know that that was the limits of your policy? Did you understand that if you had, if the insurance company had accepted that, this case would be over? And you milk that, you know, go through that, and then slide across.
Were you made aware that you could have a separate attorney evaluate this
right.
for you?
And were you aware, for example, that you, did you know that you may assign your rights, any rights you have against the insurance company? You can slide a proposed assignment right across to them right there, make it an exhibit.
Wow.
It's not unethical. It's well within the rules. You can do it in terms of the law and the timing. And they can do, and then that creates pressure because suddenly the policyholder is like, wait a second, I had a chance to get out of this.
And they know that you're not the bad guy. Like, you take the deposition, it's pretty obvious, hey, this is what we try to do.
Yeah, we were willing to do this. In fact, we did this 6 months ago or a year ago or whenever you did it. And you don't ask, what did your lawyers tell you about it? Because that would be privilege. But you can say, were you aware of that? Were you aware that we gave them all the medical records? Were you just walk them through that so that the policyholder might start to get the idea that the insurance company or the insurance defense lawyers aren't necessarily working in their best interest?
And it's, when you're in that situation, sometimes they actually will get private or coverage counsel.
Sometimes.
For that insured. And that's what it makes our jobs even more fun, because you have another person writing letters to the insurance company that will be exhibits later in a second lawsuit.
Right.
You know?
And that's, you made a good point, which is that policy limit demand letter that you're talking about is going to be an exhibit in a subsequent trial. And so it needs to be written in plain English.
And I like to make them a little bit, like, fun. I like to think if it's an exhibit or it's read to the jury, say, look, you know, we're really not trying to hurt this person. We're just want the insurance company to do the right thing. Just please step up. Nobody wants to go through this trial. It's hard on everybody. I'm sure it's hard on your insured, that kind of stuff.
Well, but I look at that a little bit differently. Yes, you say, to me, I say you're telling it like it is, which is, there's a human aspect to all this, right? It's easy to get caught up as lawyers in the legal technical stuff and the rules and the regulations and whatever. But what you just said is exactly right. People buy insurance for peace of mind.
Yep.
And here you had an opportunity. You've given the insurance company an opportunity to end this within the limits of coverage so that they don't have to spend more than whatever's written into the contract. And they rejected that. Now, they have a right to do it, but the question is who's bearing that burden, and some of it is the policyholder.
So let me ask you, we got 5 more minutes to go here. One of the last things I want to talk to you about, some more fun stuff. I want to know the most egregious or funny things you have seen in a claims adjuster's file or doing a case and you're just like, I can't believe they said that. I can't believe they did that type situation.
Well, you'll see things, for example, sends so-and-so to Dr. Smith, but if Dr. Smith won't tell us what we want, send him to Dr. Jones because Dr. Jones wants our business or whatever.
What?
You'll have things like that, or an email that says, don't put this in the claim file because
don't put this document in the claim file.
Or,
and then it ended up there, of course.
Yes. And then sometimes you'll see adjusters are human too, and sometimes they don't understand how they come across. Like, for example, one time I had a case where there was some back and forth, and the adjuster clearly taken a dislike to the plaintiff's lawyer. Right or wrong, she did.
Well, I know some lawyers that purposely try to tick off the insurance adjusters. Because they're trying to open up the policy or make a mistake. I see this. I'm like, come on, man, don't
well,
do that.
Well, and in this instance, what happened was the adjuster was on the phone with the plaintiff's lawyer, and she says, you know, she's taking contemporaneous notes. She types, I asked for X, Y, and Z. And he goes, oh, I'll send it right now. And they're in the file, you see an email sent in the middle of the call with X.
Wow.
He just attached the wrong document. And she notes in the file, like, he did not send me the thing I asked for. And she's on the phone with him. It's like, why didn't you just ask him for the right document? And she didn't have a good answer for it. And she just decided she wasn't going to pay the policy limit, even though it was a brain-damaged child.
What?
And there was a $100,000 limit on the policy. And she just took it on herself that she didn't like the case. And I don't know if it was a racial thing or an ethnic thing.
I have a sneaking suspicion that one insurance carrier, I've seen over and over them taking a systematic advantage of their Hispanic, non-English-speaking insureds. I mean, it's the same one. Every time I do it, they're doing the exact same thing to them, hanging them out to dry. And I'm like, I've talked to another lawyer that does bad faith, and they're like,
Can we have a talk? Because I also prosecute class actions against insurance companies,
so maybe we need to talk. Yeah, I think we should. Class actions against, man, see, this is the high-level stuff, man. This is above my pay grade.
It's going right in the devil's bedroom, just directly at him, you know?
Do you have bulletproof windows? Are you ever afraid of
it? I was just about to ask that.
It'd be nice to be that important that someday I have to worry about that, but so far, no. But they, like, going back to what I said earlier, which is, they're Democratic, they do it to everybody. But I think you're right. I've been approached in the past by lawyers who are representing clients who, sometimes Hispanic, sometimes other ethnic minorities, that the insurance companies have decided that population of people, they don't trust them.
Dude. Well, I had a case, the one bad faith case ever, and it was so egregious, like, yeah, I can do this. And they did, and with the stuff that we got, and it said this guy was Hispanic with tattoos, and they just pegged him as a criminal.
Right.
And, like, he legit got robbed, they stole his stuff, and they tried to, and they're like, he must have been in on it. That's what they said. Like, this guy, he was a straight-laced guy, Hispanic with tattoos and a shaved head. They just said, yep, that's how it is. I mean, come on.
And well, in the subsequent bad faith case, what you will see then is they're, in the industry, they'll call it red flags or whatever. And if they've got lists of red flags, and the question is, are they legitimate or not, or are they racially motivated or motivated against an ethnic minority? I haven't had the good fortune to have one of those cases where I could put it all together. It's all anecdotal at this point. Mm-hmm. And it can be a real challenge in California because courts, I've had some success at it, but they're frequently reluctant to certify cases as class actions when it involves claims handling. Because the reflexive sort of non-thinking attitude is, or unthinking attitude is, well, every claim is different. So we could never certify as a class because it's not going to all be the same. We have to look at every claim individually. But I think if you can get sufficient evidence to show that either through internal documents or enough anecdotal evidence that they have a pattern that everyone, for example, every Spanish speaker who's from a poor community or something because they won't fight back, if you can get there, I think that I certainly have had anecdotal evidence that that's happening. Hmm. But I haven't had the case yet where I've been able to develop the evidence
or dig into the internal documents.
I think that's certainly possible. And I've heard enough from colleagues whom I trust who aren't, I don't think, reflexively looking for a problem, saying they're seeing things that they are finding hard to dismiss. We'll see what happens.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. We could talk all day about this. But, Michael, could you tell our listeners how they can find you?
My name is Michael Cohen. You can find me. My law firm is Michael O. Cohen, a professional law corporation. It's on Westwood Boulevard, 2300 Westwood Boulevard in Los Angeles. And the web address is www.mlcplclaw.com. mlcplclaw.com.
Cool. Well, Michael, thanks for coming on. Brett, thanks for being here. You know, I'm glad you got your first little little taste of the podcast.
Yeah, me too. I think there's a lot of insurance adjusters just deleting emails and files right now.
One click per minute, right? Well, probably no, per click per second. All right, well, Mike, thanks for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening to this episode of Justice Team Podcast. Any questions, media@justiceteam.com. And remember, Brett, what's the tagline? You got to know this. No sleep till justice. Thank you.
All right, welcome to sunny San Diego for another episode of the Justice Team Podcast. If you are usually view our podcast on YouTube, you can see we're not in our normal studio. We're in a Carney van, Airstream. So we took it on the road. We're here in San Diego. We have Jack Zinda with us today. He is a Texas-based lawyer, but as you'll find out, he's pretty much in every state in the union.
He's everywhere.
Jack's in the house. Don't mess with Texas.
Great to be here, guys. Thank you.
Sorry you had to fly into this shitty weather and leave beautiful Texas for San Diego. But
this is awful. I'd much rather be back in 110 degrees.
Yeah.
So, Evan, we got Evan with us today. Evan Garcia.
Yep. Fellow Texan, but out here. I saw the light. I'm out here in California and with the Justice Team.
And Grayson Goody.
Hey, good to be here. Wyoming, all from Wyoming. We were just actually discussing how Wyoming is a much better state than Texas. You know, you don't mess with Texas, but
well, Texas
Wyoming
is a union,
has so much
it?
More.
Yeah, it, right? Is Texas a union? No.
Is it?
I mean,
I believe it's its own country.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. going to be seceding from the union.
And
I
don't think I introduced myself. I'm Brandon Simon. Thanks for tuning in. Jack, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, man. It's great to be here.
So you're based out of Texas. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Our firm is based out of Boston. We also have an office in Denver and one in Dallas as well. We do exclusively personal injury cases, just like you guys, primarily trucking, catastrophic injury, and we handle cases not just in Texas and Colorado, but throughout the U.S.
Now, what's the saying? What's the saying about Austin? Is it keep Austin weird?
Keep Austin weird.
What's so weird about Austin?
It's not so
You're
weird.
You ever been to Austin?
it used to be weird. Now it is like
Now it's like
central.
Too cool to be weird,
yeah,
right?
Way
now
too
it's
cool.
Very normal.
It's very hipster. Keep Austin hipster.
Ugh. Ugh, hipsters. So we have a common link here. Like Evan said, Evan's a Texas boy. Houston, born and bred.
H-Town, yep.
A big A&M fan, right? Gig'em.
Negative. That's more my dad would disown me.
Jack, are you born and bred Texas?
I was born in a small town called Longview in East Texas. It's about 2 hours east of Dallas. You would really have no reason to go there if you were going to Texas.
Well, how's the high school football team in Longview?
Actually, we're pretty good. Number 3 in the country.
What?
A few given points, yeah.
There you go.
There's a good reason to go.
Yeah. So, your main office is in Austin. How many offices do you have?
Right now, we have 3 main offices: one in Austin, one in Denver, and one in Dallas. And we have satellite offices throughout Texas, Colorado, Arizona, and New Mexico. We've got 26 attorneys in the firm.
Wow.
One of them, Neil Solomon's over there.
Yeah, there he is. Hey, Neil. Wow.
Hey guys, how's it going?
You're kind of hidden from view there.
Yeah, that's it.
I can't see you, Neil, but I can hear you. I can hear you, buddy.
So, Neil, you're with Jack as well?
That's correct. Yeah, I'm in the Austin office with Jack.
Okay, right on. So one of the 28.
That's it.
Okay.
Can I ask a question real quick, Jack?
No.
Why are you having your offices all over the country? I mean, you're in how many different states now?
Well, right now we are in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado.
Wow.
And a lot of it is by necessity. So Texas is one of the most anti-consumer, anti-plaintiff states in the country. This is an outdated statistic, but at one point, the Texas Supreme Court was ruling against consumers 89% of the time.
Wow.
And that, I came into my practice in 2006, just when the biggest tort reform had just been passed in legislature. So over time, by out of necessity and just good fortune, we've had cases outside of Texas. And we decided to make a move to look for business where it's a little easier to practice law.
Right. And I got a quick question on that, though. When you're looking elsewhere and you're looking for, I guess you could say, just different jurisdictions, I mean, in your experience, what does your team look at? I mean, what are the pros and cons? I mean, obviously, I'd imagine jury pools, but, I mean, Do you look at caps? I mean, what else is at play there?
Good question.
I mean, I think the first thing you have to look at is why are you looking at taking a case outside of your home state? And for us, it's can we add value in some sort of specialization, whether it's a construction case or a trucking case? Do we think we can add value? Or is it better to be with a local attorney there? Secondarily, a lot of times it is advantageous to look at what are the different laws in that jurisdiction. So if you have a case where someone's hurt in Texas, but the defendant's based out of Florida and the driver is based out of Minnesota, if you kind of expand your mind and look at all those different options, it allows you to figure out what's best for the client.
Right. Awesome.
And so you have attorneys barred in each of those states, or how does that work?
I'm licensed in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. Burgess Williams, who's off to the side over there, is licensed in about 15 states.
Wow.
One of the things is once you get past the five-year mark, it's not that difficult to get licensed in other jurisdictions. You know, as long as you stay on the good side of the bar.
That sounds easy, doesn't it?
Yeah. In California, there's no, they call it reciprocity. You can only practice in California. You don't get reciprocity in any other states, which seems strange, but I guess they want to keep your property taxes here, right? Or not your property taxes, but your income taxes.
Income taxes, yeah. Right. But I feel like, in Wyoming, it's the same thing. You can be in any state as long as you're practicing for 5 years and you're in good standing. You can wave right into Wyoming. So I take it that's probably the same with the states that you guys have been into.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, we've been intentional about asking our new attorneys to get licensed in other jurisdictions.
Smart.
You know, and so I think now we have Minnesota, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, D.C., Florida. And so it gives us more options.
So say you got Burgess over there and you have a case that, the driver's in Minnesota. You file that case in Minnesota because you think that's advantageous to file there. Do you just send Burgess out there to litigate it, or are you getting local counsel, or how does that work?
Well, I think first you got to make sure you know what you're doing. I think that is key. You got to know what the rules of civil procedure are, the rules of evidence in that jurisdiction. And then you got to think, does it make sense from the client's point of view to file that case there? And does it make sense from the case point of view and from the firm point of view? You can't take a small case, several thousand miles away. It just doesn't justify it.
So I want to talk a little bit about your practice. You are the namesake of your firm, right? Zinda Law Firm, is that what it is?
Zinda Law Group.
Zinda Law Group, okay. And I'm Simon Lagerup. I'm part of the Simon Brothers. And I know how much time is taken up by running the practice and the business side of a law firm. How much of your day is spent actually being a lawyer? And how much of your day is being a manager, an owner of the firm, all the administrative stuff?
You know, I consider it a victory if I'm able to spend 25% of my time practicing law.
Yeah.
That's and I feel like that is very difficult at times. You know, we have nearly 80 employees.
80.
And so there's always some fire going on somewhere. And over time, I've had to really narrow the scope of the cases that I handle. 2 years ago, I was working on probably 15 cases at a time. Now it's down to 3.
Yeah.
And that's just out of necessity. You know, there's always something popping up. But I think it's also about being intentional and making sure you're carving out the time to actually practice law, or you find yourself, doing interviews and reviewing spreadsheets all day.
Yeah, so
that's a great point.
You know, you have offices like Simon Law Group. We have offices up and down the coast, but we're all in California. We're all relatively close to one another. You have offices thousands of miles away. How, when a fire goes up, you have to put out a fire. How difficult is that when you're managing cases that are literally another state away?
You know, what's great now with technology is you can...
what's good old great Bob with, Simon just distracting us from our work. Classic.
Our work.
Yeah.
what's great with technology now, we can get around a lot of those issues. So we use attorneys in other jurisdictions or locations that can have individual client meetings, and we'll talk to the client via Skype. And have someone on the ground to help the client there. We do a lot of travel. I mean, we probably have more Southwest points than just about anybody.
And drink tickets.
Don't forget about the drink tickets. Arizona a lot, probably. Phoenix a lot, yeah.
But in a weird way, before when we were handling cases just in Texas, going to Midland is a lot harder than getting to Denver, And so there's a lot of things that if you practice in a big state like California, you're used to driving, you're used to being on the road. And if there's a direct flight, it makes it a lot easier.
Right.
But we've had to really adopt technology to make that a lot easier, I'm sure, as you guys have.
Yeah.
Doing things like DocuSign and video conferencing and those sort of things.
Yeah, video conferencing is big. I mean, I imagine if you're handling cases in other states, you're going to have to do a lot of video depositions. I mean, we only handle cases in California, but we have, you know, as we've gotten bigger, Grayson, you're doing depots in, you know, Pennsylvania or something, and the beauty is you don't have to go to Pennsylvania to go take a deposition.
But I would prefer going to Pennsylvania to take the deposition. No. I'd never been to Philly. I went to Philly a couple months
ago. You don't
want
to go to Philly. You can go to Pittsburgh. You don't want to go to Philly.
Well, Pittsburgh. Come on. No, you know, we had a depot in Switzerland.
You're fired.
I'm looking at Bob. He didn't even catch it. Good. We had a depot in Switzerland, and Bob had the opportunity to take it via Skype, and he was like, I think I'm going to go to Switzerland.
Yeah.
So there's places you want to go. And
I don't even think that was his case. He just,
it was
I'm
my
a partner.
Case.
I'm pulling rank. I want to go to Switzerland. So Jack, let's get to know you a little bit more on a personal level. Born and raised Texas boy. Baylor undergrad?
Went to Baylor, Southwestern for undergrad.
Okay.
It's a tiny school of about 1,200 students. We actually didn't even
and
have a football
team. And you were an
athlete,
right?
Supposedly. I think it was Division III, so it barely qualifies as being an
better
athlete.
Than Division Zero.
Yeah.
It's Division Zero basketball. Yeah. So baseball, like this guy also baseball player?
Basketball player.
Basketball, okay.
What's Division Zero? Is that like intramurals where we
lose San Diego
every game?
City League.
We were on the same team.
Yeah.
We were on the same team.
But when I was in law school, I was known as the good basketball player, which is not what you want to be known for in law school. You want to be known as the guy on law review.
Grayson was the good basketball player.
Yeah, I was on law review too, so I got a double.
You got a leg up on me.
What position do you play?
Two guard.
Okay,
two guard,
cool.
So, and I've got a
I
wife.
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah, and two kids, 8 and 6 years
so
old.
So how stressful? I mean, I know I get yelled at by my wife a lot, always on the phone, working. I mean, how do you managing a firm and then also time with family?
You know, I think with everything in life that's important, you've got to be intentional. I think that is one of the big takeaways that I've learned the hard way over the years. And I used to work, you know, 7 days a week, every waking minute. But now with kids, I've found ways to manage my time by saying, for example, you know, Saturday is off limits for work, unless just absolutely necessary. And then I usually pick things back up, you know, Sunday evening. But if you don't do that, if you don't carve out that time, the law in your business will consume everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I've also found that I'm a better lawyer if I take a break. You know, going for a run, playing with my kids, my mind gets refreshed. Yeah. And I tell that to the younger associates too. I think there's a diminishing return on working, you know, so many hours. If you're working, and by the way, I know very few people that actually work 80 hours. You know, you hear that a lot. I worked 80 hours this week. How much of that was actually productive? How much of that did you actually get stuff done versus you just sat at your desk stressed out about all the work you had to do?
Yeah, balance is so important. Balance is so important. You know, I've found and I've forced myself to do this is after every trial, I'll try to get out and take like 3 or 4 days where I'm just like, you know, take care of the things that need to be taken care of. Laundry, hanging out with my wife,
the cat.
Going to the beach. Don't forget about the kitties. You know, going shooting hoops or something like that. You know, having that balance is so important as an attorney, and it's good that you're telling your younger attorneys that.
And Jack, I think to follow up on that, I think you've said it a few times, and I think it really resonates, is this idea of being, intentional. So either intentionally hang out with your kids, you know, separate, you know, work from you know, real life or, you know, family time. And then, you know, likewise, if you're at your desk, I mean, are you really being productive? Are you really being, good with your and smart with your time?
Or is Evan coming into your office and playing your arcade machine?
We call that arcade machine.
Who's got an arcade machine in their office?
We call it the malpractice machine.
Yeah, malpractice machine. But is it something that, I mean, do you share with Neil, you know, some of this insight? As far as, you know, being intentional, I mean, is this something that, is that like part of your firm values? Or
I mean, I
like
think
that?
One thing we try to do is take things that work throughout the firm and create processes and systems that we can give to the other attorneys. You know, I'm sure you guys have seen this. You know, one of the most expensive, important decisions you make in a case is hiring an expert witness, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do you train a 3 to 5 year attorney to make a good decision that could be a $50,000 investment? So we've done things to create processes to make that possible. And I think with everything, it's about creating systems and being intentional on that standpoint.
Actually, I just got handed a viewer question live. I think we got a live viewer question.
I'm looking at Burgess over there.
It's from Dina Joseph. So shout out to Dina. Her email is she's at Sun Ocean Skies. So Dina Joseph at Sun Ocean Skies. Interested in specializing in catastrophic personal injury, TBIs. So any specialized courses, seminars, organizations, anything that they could consider doing while they were in law school to kind of shift their way towards that area of the law.
I mean, I think, one, getting involved in organizations like AAJ early is helpful, but also if you want to be involved in, for example, traumatic brain injury, learn the medicine. I think that is one of the most undervalued areas of being a personal injury lawyer, is figure out what's the latest on how brain injury cases work. If that's an area of focus that you want to go into, then do clerkships, get to know PLRs, make sure that's what you actually want to do. I think when you come out of law school, you need to have a plan. Where do you want to see your practice, you know, at least 2-3 years, and not just let it, you know, come hit you. But I'd say local trial lawyers associations are great. AJ's great. And then if traumatic brain injury is where you want to be, learn the latest, you know, information on diffuse tensor imaging, the latest studies on concussions, how those things work, if that's really where you want to have your focus.
And before we get you get out of here, I want to ask you, I mean, you're expanding constantly. Is there another area of the map you're looking to conquer?
What we've really focused on recently is focusing on types of cases opposed to geography. So when we say nationwide practice, it's not specifically saying, okay, we're going to take 100 cases in New York or 100 cases in California. It's more of, for this particular type of case, trucking, for example, where's the best jurisdiction? Where does that make sense? And looking at the U.S. as the map opposed to just whatever state you're in.
Right. Interesting.
Smart.
Is there, just curious, is there a particular area of the country that is more prone to, you know, say paraplegic cases or, you know, anything that's worth eight figures?
Just curious. Not that we're looking to get into that area of the country, but.
Unfortunately, I don't know of one.
Where do the most airplane crashes take place?
Right?
Cool. You guys have any other fun? You guys are Texas boys.
Yeah, I got a question, though, and I think this is, you know, Jack and I, we spoke about this, you know, briefly before we got on here, and it's news to me, but apparently in Colorado, there's a cap on the non-economic damages. I mean, what is there pending legislation? Are people trying to do something about that? I mean,
is that for all personal injury cases?
Yeah, it's for all personal injury cases. The cap is 437 right now, I believe.
It's a very specific number.
Anything
above 437
is that's a progressive state, too.
It increases for inflation, and you got to keep in mind, okay.
Someone was high when they got to that number, right?
Yeah. In Colorado? Yeah.
Well, should we do 420? No. Let's do
437. We got to count for inflation, man.
The good thing about Colorado is there's no cap on physical impairment. So there's a way you can get... So pain and suffering is capped. Physical impairment is not.
Okay.
And there's no cap on economic damages. But there's also, you know, Texas, for example, we've got the collateral source issue of paid versus incurred, where you can only get whatever was paid. So,
yeah,
for example,
California,
if you've got a person who is on Medicaid, their case is worth a lot less, unfortunately, than someone who didn't have health insurance.
Right.
In Texas, is there so in California, we have a law now that says if somebody treats on a lien and say they just forewent their insurance and treated on a lien, the reasonable value is not based on insurance. So you're not allowed to talk about insurance. Can you do that in Texas? Can you still talk about collateral sources even though they treat it on a lien basis, or is that?
No, you can't talk about collateral source, although they're trying to chip away at that. Yeah. One thing we were talking about beforehand is, you know, with the Supreme Court that is very pro insurance, our goal is to keep those cases out of the appellate courts, because that's probably where they would go next. It's typically not the legislature anymore. It's more of
good
the
point.
Courts that are turning those things over.
Very cool. Conservative courts. Are we on like a time crunch here, or do we have to stop sometime soon?
I don't know. I'm not the producer.
Well, I don't even see the producer, so let's just keep talking.
Okay.
Yeah, Jack, can I ask you a question?
Yeah,
so when you came out of law school, did you know that you were going to do this type of work? Is this what you wanted to do?
Well, you know, it's funny. I thought it's really cool how you guys have a family practice. My dad told me that's what I was going to do, but I didn't believe him.
Was your dad an attorney?
No, he was actually a restaurant owner. And that was some of the best training to be a trial lawyer. So, you know, at age 12, 13, I'm a dishwasher at my dad's bar working with, you know, minimum wage workers. Some had felony records, you know, and then waiting tables. And we had the only bar in town. And so learning how to deal with people, that was great training. But out of law school, I worked at a firm that did family law and personal injury. And it was kind of a crazy situation. They hired me to start the PI section out of law school. which in retrospect is a little nuts.
A little.
We trust you more than we trust ourselves. Yeah. Go just run with it.
That's great. Well,
you have time to figure it out. Go ahead.
It worked.
It worked. Right. And I'm very lucky the person that I worked for gave me a lot of autonomy, let me learn how to run the firm, and gave me a lot of freedom to run the marketing of the firm, the business processes. And so after doing that for a couple of years, it just made sense to branch out on my own.
It's probably an unintentional training for you to start your own firm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And one thing I'd say, if you're considering starting a PI practice now, I would advise you to consider teaming up with someone who's got good cash flow, an hourly practice. You know, in the beginning of our practice, we had an hourly section that we phased out about 3 or 4 years ago. And that really allowed us to take some more risks on bigger PI cases earlier because you had that cash flow coming in opposed to having a high interest loan or something like that.
Well, I'm getting a note from Teresa that we're going to have to wrap it up. Before we go, I want to ask, who's your favorite Texas athlete of all time?
Emmitt Smith, hands down.
Ooh, nice. I love it. I got an Emmitt Smith rookie card, actually.
What?
I do. Yeah, I think the value's gone down over the years. Yeah, it's top flight.
Well, cool. Thanks for coming, Jack. Appreciate it. Have fun in San Diego, and hopefully you can expand out here in California.
Yeah, we'll be in touch for sure.
Heck yeah.
Thanks, guys. Cool. For being here. This was fun.
Thanks,
awesome.
Jack.
Thanks.
All right. Cheers, guys.
All right, cheers.
Thanks, man. That was cool. That was awesome.
Save your tears, little one. Don't forget my friends. You destroyed evidence. All right. Show your wrong, cite the good case law. To the judgment it comes. Write my motion all night, ripping my pen so tight. Here's the site. Sanction them. No tentative. We're off to Stanley and Bosque again.